Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have back on the show Dr. E. Michael Jones. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, a prolific writer, historian. Of course, he's the author of Logos Rising, A History of Ultimate Reality, and many other books. Of course, he's also the author of The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History. That just came out this year in its second edition in three volumes. I am currently reading a third volume, and I came across an interesting chapter, chapter 8, entitled Jewish Nazis. So it's a provocative title. Jewish Nazis. Now, this is a contradiction in term, isn't it?
No, well, that's the whole point of it. Is it or is it? Because that article is, among other things, a review of a movie called The Believer. And The Believer was directed by a Jew who was fascinated by the story of a guy, a Jew, who became a Nazi, a member of the American Nazi Party, and was, you know, working with the Nazi Party, and then was exposed, and he ended up committing suicide. So Chesterton said that there were, he saw Nazism as a kind of Jewish phenomenon. The Jewish idea turned upside down. In other words, they still believed that there was a chosen people, except that now it was the Germans who were the chosen people. They were racially superior in the way that the Jews claimed before that they were racially superior. So Nazism was in many ways just a mirror image of Zionism. I don't want to refer to Judaism, because that implies it's a religion. The Jewish idea of racial superiority. Nazism was simply the flip side of that coin.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there is some, I mean, I've run across some of my research, you know, World War II and the Third Reich, and Reinhard Heydrich, the, guy who ran Bohemia and Moravia, the protectorate, was assassinated there in 1942. But he had some, I guess, some nice things to say about Zionists. And you could look at the Third Reich and Zionism as sharing a certain objective. That would have been sort of to getting the Jews out of Germany. But it goes, I guess, in your article, I suggest, as I guess, as a deeper psychological or philosophical, I guess, a linkage between the two ideologies.
Racial superiority. Mm-hmm. just comes down to who's racially superior. The Zionists also collaborated with the Nazis because they both wanted to remove Jews from Europe. Mm-hmm. They had that common goal in mind. And Theodor Herzl, obviously he's before the rise of the Nazis, but he would go around to princes in Europe before World War I and say, you know, we have the same goal. Europe, Judenrein, we do too. Send them all to Israel. And that continued even after the founding of the State of Israel, with things like the Lavan Affair, where basically the Israelis killed Jews, a kind of false flag terrorist operation in Egypt, where they blew up a synagogue to spread terror among the Jews so that they'd panic and move to Israel. So, you know, there are lots of similarities. What about terrorism? The Jews invented terrorism as a term when the Irgun and the Stern Gang would go into villages like Deir Yassin and exterminate the people. This is all the type of stuff that you see in movies about Nazis. How many times have we seen that picture of the car showing up or the truck showing up and the look of fear on the people's faces, and they're all going to be deported? Well, this is what the Israelis were doing to the Palestinians after the war. There's all kinds of similarities here that it's not conducive to your popularity among the oligarchs to bring this type of stuff up, but it's there nonetheless.
No, it's not something you bring up at cocktail parties or barbecues. No. It's not polite. No. if you look at like Jewish terrorism, something you don't, I mean, you can read a lot about it, but it isn't portrayed in Hollywood. And or if it does, it's justified. It's self-defense. And they're always practicing self-defense They're the ones being attacked. Yeah.
Proactive self-defense. So, so there's a recent movie came out. I kept trying to see it, but apparently it hasn't been released, but it's been filmed, and it's called Plan A. And it's about, it's an Israeli movie about how after the war, a group of Jews got together and decided to poison the water supply in Germany and kill Germans indiscriminately. Well, and it's portrayed as if this is something noble. Wait a minute. Can I disagree here? Does that make me a bad person if I don't think that's a noble thing to do? And then we go back to Hunters, which I also reviewed, with Al Pacino playing this Jew who's saying, it's not murder, it's mitzvah to go out and kill someone you think is a Nazi. Well, usually we have trials for this type of thing. But no, it's okay. If you think he's a Nazi, you have a right to kill him. The Jew has a right to kill anybody. Well, is it too strong to say that he doesn't like? Well, if you don't like the person and you pin the label Nazi on him, then it's okay to kill him. This is a type of barbarism and anarchy that gets spread through our culture in the name of tolerance and in the name, because Jews are doing it. We also have Spielberg's movie Munich, where he tries to distance himself a little bit from this. This is a revenge, which is a Jewish virtue, against the Palestinians for the Munich Olympic massacres. And so in this movie, as I said, Spielberg tries to distance himself a little bit from it by showing misgivings. You know, some of the people start to have misgivings. So it's a hit squad. And the first thing is they show up on a street in Italy, and there's this distinguished professor of philology. And they're saying, are you so-and-so? And he's kind of shaking there because they have guns drawn on him. So they hold up a picture next to him, and there his hand is shaking. Everybody, it's a total train wreck. Everybody's upset, you know, and they just shoot the guy. Well, maybe it was the wrong picture. How do you deal with this? And Spielberg at the end did try to deal with it because they all kind of go crazy, the hit squad. But what you see here is that was the a first instance. And after you're softened up by that because of that kind of moral hand-wringing that Spielberg engages in, then you're set up for Hunters, where there's no moral hand-wringing at all. It's obvious that these people deserve to die because some Jew thinks he's a Nazi, and that suspicion is enough to be a death warrant. Well, wait a minute, this is horrible. And if you object to it, you're an anti-Semite. Well, how far is this going to go? How far do we have to go, descend into barbarism and the absolute contempt that these people hold for all the basics of civilization, rule of law, trial by jury, all of these type of things, rules of evidence? How far do we have to go here? I don't know. But I it's a very troubling phenomenon. And Jewish, the movie The Believer was an early attempt to deal with this type of stuff, deal with this whole business of Nazism and how it got appropriated, and the kind of strange story of a Jew who was attracted to it.
Yeah, and of course the label Nazi or white supremacist it can be attached to anyone, applied to anyone who is perceived as a political adversary or a problem. And of course we see that most recently with our esteemed Attorney General Merrick Garland writing a memo saying that his Justice Department, the FBI, are going to investigate parents who have the audacity to show up at school board meetings to voice their opinions about, you know, the maladministration of the public school system they pay for and the indoctrination of their kids. And that's perceived, yes, again, as being white supremacist. He didn't use the word Nazi, but again, domestic terrorism. It's another
domestic terrorist is the word he used.
Yeah.
So now the FBI is going to be on your case if you show up and disagree with the school board about books that they bought. And the books in this instance, I saw that video
yes.
of the lady in Virginia. The books, this book is a graphic glorification of pedophilia.
And a violation of state law, by the way.
I do mean graphic, with pictures of this pedophile sex in the book, plus a text that glorifies this type of thing. So if you object to that, you're a domestic terrorist. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that the guy who's head of the school board is a Jew and a homosexual. Well, that's two, wait a minute, that's two reasons he cannot be criticized. That's two reasons he's always right, no matter what he does, even to the point of promoting pedophilia, even to that point, which is what seemed to be the last taboo.
Yeah, and of course, the I just read today that the Randy Weingarten, she's the head of the Federation of Teachers, praised the move by the Justice Department. And so we have a Jewish attorney general being praised by a Jewish head of a teachers union for a school board that's headed by a Jewish homosexual for promoting pedophilia and degeneracy and these things. And so, and then again, another wrinkle in this is that his daughter, Merrick Garland's daughter, is married to this guy, Alexander Tanner, who owns this outfit called Panorama Education, which makes millions of dollars a year selling material to critical race theory, curriculum or programs throughout the country.
His
family's making money off the deal. Then you get the spectacle of him using his official position to intimidate critics of these programs. It's so audacious. It's a chutzpah, isn't it?
So why don't we have a campaign to ban the FBI? So it's obvious with some like this in charge, this is it puts the Cheka to shame. Mm-hmm. The secret, the extraordinary committee to combat terrorism and counter-revolution, which was created in the Soviet Union 1 month after the October Revolution, 1 month later, in order to spread terror throughout the population in the name of combating terrorism. Mm-hmm. And what does that have in common with Merrick Garland? Well, the Cheka was a predominantly Jewish operation because the people in charge realized that Russians wouldn't torture and murder other Russians. So they had to have Jews, and there were a lot of Latvians involved too. You had to have a foreign element here. And the Jews always consider themselves a foreign element, that were just in Russia because of some political quirk after having been for generations in Poland at the time. So you have the same type of operation here. We have the same type of operation in Germany with the Stasi, the secret police, the Staatssicherheitsdienst. And the only reason we know about that to some extent is because that regime fell and we were granted access to the archives. So who was in charge of the Stasi? Well, it was Marcus Wolf, who happens to be a Jew as well. And when Marcus Wolf suddenly found himself unemployed, no problem. We have a gig for you here. Michael Chertoff invited him over to the United States, and he became a consultant for Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. So it's one instance after another where this tiny minority always gravitates to these situations where they can control the operation and demonize anybody that disagrees with them. Because they have Jewish privilege, and they can use all of the worst cuss words in the book, namely anti-Semite, and then they can invent whatever they want to: white supremacist, domestic terrorist, deplorable, all of these labels, all of these categories of the mind that get imposed on people as a way of demonizing them, so that then you can say they deserve whatever they get. This is exactly what happened to the Germans after World War II. Mm-hmm. They were demonized, and this mythology, this literary tradition that I've already mentioned, with things like films like Schindler's List and
the narrative, if you will.
The narrative began, and it began by convincing the Germans that they were bad people. And it succeeded to a large extent, that the Germans they go along with this guilt trip for some reason or other. I have my own reason. I lived there in the 1970s, And I think what happened here during that period of time is that the press was always controlled in Germany after World War II. There was nothing that didn't have to get a license. And at that point, some point in the 50s, early 60s, they started promoting sexual liberation. The Kinsey Report became a household word. The word report became a German word, mm-hmm. actually. And at that point, you corrupted the morals of the German people. I was teaching at a gymnasium at that point, and one of the prime targets was the schoolgirls, to corrupt the morals of the schoolgirls. And they were supposed to read magazines like Bravo. Bravo was a teen fan magazine with the latest heartthrob on the cover. But you opened it, and there was Dr. Sommer, who was advising the girls on how to masturbate or things like that.
Yeah.
That was always part of what he was doing. Well, it turns out his name was Goldstein. It wasn't Sommer. And he was engaging in the corruption of the sexual morality of these people. Well, that causes guilt. And so what happens is you create the guilt and then you mobilize the guilt. So basically, it's okay. I understand that you feel guilty. Keep doing what you're doing that's really making you feel guilty. But we'll channel and say what you really feel is guilt because of the Holocaust. That's what happened at this period of time. And a whole generation fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. Because, as I said, the guilt came along with a permission slip. And it happened here, too. I mean, all of these women who protest about abortion, I suspect a large number of them have had abortions. And once you've had something that terrible, you're going to be plagued. And your conscience, you have two choices. You can go to confession and Jesus Christ through the priest will forgive your sins, or you can, so that marching down the street with 3 million people, you don't feel alone and your conscience doesn't bother you as much. It's the same story over and over and over again. The Jews were behind abortion in this country. There's another chapter in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit that covers that. Mm-hmm. They are behind sexual liberation, both here and in Germany. And they manipulate the guilt in the same way in both places.
Yeah. And it's almost as the guilt is multi-generational or transgenerational. And so is the victimhood status of the Jews.
Right.
So the two go hand in hand. Like, why would someone 18 years old feel guilty in 1970 about World War II? They weren't even around yet, but they're trained to feel guilty about something that their fathers or their grandfathers supposedly did. The narrative is somewhat problematic, and it's, you know, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now. But in the article, you talk about Jewish nihilism and how this was a product of exposure to the German Enlightenment, to the Shtetl Jews. And this produced denialism, but then eventually manifests this revolutionary urge that's always there or is there. And this manifests also in violence. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, if there's nothing, then what is there? Well, there's obviously not nothing. Wait a minute. What do you mean by nothing? Do you mean there's no order to the universe? Is that what you're saying? You mean there's no moral order to the universe? There's no hierarchy, that the czar really has nothing holding him up there but some type of tradition? I think that's what you mean. Then your will becomes supreme. And then you impose the order on nothing because there's nothing there to hinder you. I think that's the way it works. But the guy who did The Believer was had real strong sense of that, because he kept the Jewish Nazi in that keeps saying there's nothing. And he learned that there's nothing by going to the synagogue. And this brings up metaphysical issues here, because the man who's really the key figure in this is Jacques Derrida, the French deconstructor, who comes from a long line of Algerian rabbis, and who was fascinated by nothing. Oh, wait a minute. it gets complicated here, because it becomes pretty clear that nothing is something to these people. There's something to nothing.
We read a lot of books about nothing, right?
much to do about nothing here.
Yeah.
which is pretty much Jacques Derrida in a nutshell. What does he mean by nothing? By he means the absence of presence. And he always, what does he mean by presence? He means the real presence. He talks about the real presence because he's obviously talking about Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about the disappearance of the real presence in Judaism. The real presence was called the Shekinah, which was like the God's spirit in the temple. Well, that disappeared when the temple was destroyed. Actually, it disappeared when Jesus Christ died because the veil, which symbolized the Shekinah, was rent in half. And that shows the departure of the Shekinah from the chosen people and its new presence in Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ's presence, the real presence in the Eucharist, which is then in the tabernacle of the church. So the Jews have nothing at this point, but they're going to make a big deal about nothing. And that's precisely what the hero of the believer learned by going to a synagogue. It evaporated. It evaporated. And you can't, nature abhors a vacuum. And so therefore, what do you put in its place? You put some type of revolutionary violence in its place. Because that's all there is. There's nothing left but your will, and you collectivize that will. You join it with the working class, whatever you want to call it, and then you'll be able to change the world, and you'll be able to make something out of nothing, which I think is what Bolshevism was. It's making something out of nothing.
Tikkun Olam. So this is their, repair of the world. In that movie, I think it ends with him ascending some stairs, sees his teacher. This is after he blows himself up, and this is his afterlife. And he's continually walking upstairs. What's the phrase? It's nothingness forever or something. In the movie.
Nihilism. It's similar to the Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man.
Yeah.
Where they're constantly the poor Schlemiel, he's like the Job, the modern day Job, the professor. Everything bad happens to him, and he goes to the rabbis, and they've got nothing to say. And then there's the ultimate rabbi, who was the epitome of wisdom, rabbinic wisdom, Talmudic wisdom, and he finally gets to him, and he starts singing a Jefferson Airplane song.
Yeah. Somebody to
and
love.
That's that. Don't you need somebody
to love?
So there's nothing there. And I think this is the specter, if you want to use that word again, that haunts the Jewish people. The specter that there's nothing here. Maybe we missed the boat. Maybe the time of our visitation came and we didn't see it. That's too terrible to contemplate. And so we have to get together and we have to take over the world. And they're succeeding. They're succeeding.
It's born out of their rejection of Jesus Christ, which, as you write, it's a rejection of Logos. And because of that, Jesus, the incarnation made, I guess, their status as a chosen people obsolete, if you will. And there was a new covenant, and they don't want to give that up. They don't want to give up that status, but they've lost the temple. There's nothingness. So what do you got? You have revolution, which, of course, there's a lot of time here, but, as Europe developed and they established their place in Europe, they became sort of this, a seed of revolution as the time arrived. I was just reading today about Christopher Columbus. Of course, around Columbus time, and some of the critical tracts against Christopher Columbus were written by conversos. So it's and then published by publishers in the Netherlands. Of course, the Jewish publishers in the Netherlands were expelled by the Spanish crown in 1492, in the early 16th century, the whole converso crisis. And so you see the Black Legend itself has a Jewish source to it.
Yes.
How far these things go back. It's interesting. The source of Jewish revolutionary and violence is this nihilism. Of course, this is the shtetl. This is the Pale of the Settlement. And they cause a lot of trouble in Russia in the 19th century.
That's right.
Yeah, but this then a lot of them go to the United States, which has a which then blows back to Russia, because a lot of these wealthy Jews in the United States became financiers and they funded the revolution in 1917.
Right. Jacob Schiff being the most prominent example. But they also took over the press. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you had the propaganda about the pogroms all being broadcast in the American press because it was owned by Jews. So the Kishinev pogrom is something that Solzhenitsyn talks about in his book, 200 Years Together, which is the history of the Jews in Russia and the Soviet Union. And he talks in there about how the Roosevelt called in the Russian ambassador and said that Theodore Roosevelt, I'm talking about now, after the Kishinev pogroms, and said you can't impede the ability of American salesmen to travel around Russia and sell their wares. Well, what he forgot to say was that these American businessmen were Russian Jews who came over to the United States. They buy Colt revolvers. They take them back to the shtetl and they start supplying the Jews there with guns. And the Jews then go out and set up a picture of the Tsar, and they use it as target practice, outraging the Russians there. And this is all reported. So this is the Kishinev pogrom. It led to the Kishinev pogrom, which was reported here. But he said that the Jews who were killed by being beaten, and the Russians who were killed were all shot. So they were there. The Jews had guns and the Russians didn't. This is the story that this simply is not getting told about how the media were being manipulated at that time, leading up to even before World War I, poisoning the American mind against Russians, which is pretty much what they've been doing here lately as well. So some things never change. And so what you see here is this ancestral Jewish animus against Russia, which manifests itself in the neoconservatives. That whole story of the rise of neoconservatism, part of the anti-communist crusade, the whole getting the Jews out of the Soviet Union, that whole Scoop Jackson story, the people that worked for him becoming part of the neoconservative movement, continuing to this day. Now they're in remission because I think they're, in spite of their chutzpah, there's a sort of odium which has now attached itself to the neoconservatives, especially after the debacle in Iraq and the recent, or even more recent, debacle in Afghanistan. So they're not thumping their chests anymore. They're kind of in remission right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the article, you talk or you write about rather the Georg Ratzinger, the great uncle of Benedict XVI, and his take on this. You also discuss things like figures like Professor MacDonald.
Right,
and his writings, and he writes sort of, it takes a sociobiological view, or a Darwinian approach to these things.
Yeah,
and you have an interest because he has actually, although he criticizes Jewish power, he has sort of an admiration for it, which you write is some of a contradiction. So could you sort of explain maybe the difference between Georg Ratzinger's approach and maybe Professor MacDonald's, although there are several decades different, that they're both offer something to the question.
Yeah, Georg Ratzinger was Pope Benedict's great uncle and a Catholic priest who retained his Catholic faith and saw the Catholic faith as the solution to the Jewish problem. At that point in history, you could be a Catholic in good standing and say there was a Jewish problem. Okay, that things have changed since then, which is something we should talk about as well. Kevin MacDonald, on the other hand, used to be a Catholic, lost the faith when he went to the University of Wisconsin during the 60s, which is a time of revolutionary ferment. The Jews had taken over the University of Wisconsin to a large extent. There was the Rotzi building got blown up, and there were all sorts of problems associated, but also you had the sexual revolution there. So Ron Radosh ended up, he was a Jew, wrote a memoir called Commies. He was a Jew from New York City who was a member of the Communist Party. And he was told by the Communist Party to go to the University of Wisconsin and subvert what was going on there, take control of it, engage in revolutionary activity there. The Solons of Wisconsin woke up one day after the ROTC building got blown up and they realized, hey, we have a Jewish problem here in Wisconsin. But you can't say that. Polite people don't say that. And so what they did was they simply raised tuition for out-of-state people, all out-of-state people. They should have just banned Jews from going to the University of Wisconsin because they tried to overthrow the government there. But nobody could do that. After World War II, nobody can do that anymore. What did Joe McCarthy and Joseph Stalin have in common? Not much, but they did have one thing in common. They could not say the word Jew. Even Stalin didn't want to say the word Jew. So he used circumlocutions like rootless cosmopolitans. And of course, or the doctor's plot. That was another way of talking about Jews. Even though he had purged the Jews like Zinoviev and Radek and those people during the show trials of the 1930s. Well, Joe McCarthy had the same problem. And not only that, he gets a guy... Roy Cohn as his assistant. Well, bad move, Joe. But he couldn't say it. And so as a result, this thing kept festering. Now, to get back to Georg Ratzinger, his most famous descendant was Joseph Ratzinger. Joseph Ratzinger was born in 1928. No, wait a minute. I'm sorry, 1927. So he's a very old man, approaching 100 years old now. And so that means he's 20 years old in 1947. What happened over the summer of, the winter of 1946-47? This is the Germans were defeated. Their Germany is prostrate now, completely destroyed by Allied bombing. And as if that's not bad enough, we have the plan to deal with them. It's called the Morgenthau Plan. And it's named after the Secretary of Treasury, Morgenthau, Henry Morgenthau, who has some mysterious power over Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is now dying. And so the Morgenthau Plan is basically they're going to starve the Germans to death. Again, we're back to this thing. It's okay. It's okay because Jews are doing it to Germans. When Germans do it to Jews, that's a war crime. But when Jews do it to Germans, well, it's understandable. And you have a Hollywood movie justifying it. As far as I know, there's no Hollywood movie about the Morgenthau Plan, but there is a series, a Netflix series called The Defeated, just came out. And I'm saying there's an indication of the shift that's going on in the German mind at this point is that this is about 46. This is about 1946. It's not about 45. This is in the post-war period. And what's going on here? Well, the Germans are starving to death. Cardinal Frings, who was the cardinal, basically the primate of Germany at this point, then tells the German people that over the winter of 46, 47, which is now officially known as Das Hungerjahr, the hunger year in Germany, tells the German people that they have a right. If you have no food, and there's a warehouse near you. The Americans have.
Okay, there we go. We're back. Sorry about that. Okay. Where were we?
So it's 47. The German people are being starved to death by the Jew, Morgenthau, Secretary of Treasury Morgenthau. Joseph Ratzinger is 20 years old. Now, do you know if you're hungry when you're 20 years old? You know, if you're 2 weeks old, you know if you're hungry. So he knows he's hungry. He knows the entire German people is being starved to death. He knows who's doing it because everybody knew about the Morgenthau Plan in Germany. He knows that Cardinal Frings has stood up against this man. He knows at the same time that his uncle, his great uncle, who wrote Jewish Business Practices, had an explanation of what's going on. So what do you do in a situation like this? After this point, Ratzinger and the entire post-war generation is subject to a ruthless form of social engineering, which basically blames them for their own misery. You deserve it, okay? And so at this point, you've got two separate explanations. I'm talking about Pope Benedict the 16th. He's got these two explanations. How do you reconcile these two explanations? How do you do that? How do you reconcile what you know because you're hungry, what you know because of your family, what you know because of your faith, and how do you reconcile that with what you know because the Americans control the media and the Jews control the license to get to the media? So what do you do? What do you do?
Well, in that situation,
give me what you think. How do you resolve this contradiction?
Intellectually, there's no way to resolve it.
Well, one is true and the other is false, right? The one is is true because of all the things I mentioned. The other thing you know is false. Now, I think that Ratzinger basically internalized the commands of his oppressors. Mm-hmm. I think that's what he did. And I think that's what Vatican II was, certainly for the Germans. It was a way of kind of sanitizing themselves, of escaping from this burden of guilt. Now, Ratzinger uses words like Auschwitz. He also came up with when he became Pope, he came up with this novel approach to the Jewish question. Doesn't talk about the Jewish question, but he talks about there's no missio for the Jewish people. He starts off by saying there, Jesus Christ says there's a universal commission, the Great Commission, go out and baptize all nations in the name of Jesus Christ, to bring Jesus Christ to them, evangelization. With one exception, he says, and that's the Jews. Well, wait a minute, where did that exception come from? Where is that in scripture? You have the opposite in the Acts of the Apostles. Now, we know that Benedict went to Jerusalem and gave a speech, okay? There's a precedent here because Peter went to Jerusalem. And we know what Peter said because it's the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles. He went to Jerusalem and he said to the Jews, "You killed Christ." It then says, the Jews were cut to the heart. And then they said to Peter, "What must we do to be saved?" And he said, "You have to be baptized." That's it. That's the only mandate that that a pope has, because a pope is the successor of Peter. That's the only mandate. And so that's what Ratzinger should have said when he went to Jerusalem, but he did not say that. He talked about Catholic Jewish dialogue. And then he gave up with this explanation saying, there's no missio to the Jews. In other words, we don't have this program to convert the Jews. We have dialogue instead. Well, wait a minute. First of all, these are categories of the mind you just made up. Okay. The category of reality is Peter, you killed Christ. That's what he said. That was also dialogue, even according to Ratzinger's terms. That should have been what happened here. What is the dialogue? Peter spoke to the Jews, the Jews responded, and he told them what they needed to do. That's dialogue. It's not as if he's descended from heaven and said, "You're going to do this." He didn't have any power to do anything. The Jews were in control in Jerusalem, not this group of people, the apostles, no. So he was engaging in dialogue, but this Catholic Jewish dialogue that took place was not that. It was a category of the mind that in many ways was to thwart dialogue. If by dialogue you mean a serious exchange of point of view leading to some type of successful conclusion. The culmination of what Ratzinger called Catholic Jewish dialogue came very recently when Pope Francis preached on the epistle to the Galatians, Paul's epistle to the Galatians. And the rabbi said, "No, you can't do that." That's the culmination of Catholic Jewish dialogue. Not sitting down with the Jews and say, "Look, you're in charge of this pornography industry. We want you to do something, or we're going to do something. No, it's nothing like that. It never came to anything like that. It was always the Jews badgering the church to make concessions, and with the ultimate goal of prohibiting the church from preaching the gospel.
Yeah, it's Jews telling the church who can be canonized, who they can canonize, right. Or right. who can be let back into the church, or what gospel, how the gospel should be written, or how it should be rewritten, or whether you can have a passion play or not. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's all been one-sided. There's been no dialogue because basically the church has abandoned any attempt to convert the Jews. Ratzinger said dialogue was going to convert the Jews, or that's the task. Well, he didn't engage in dialogue. Nobody did. Nobody did. It was all just sort of one-sided and making concession after concession, to the point where Cardinal Keeler of Baltimore basically came up with dual covenant theology and said, the Jews can be saved by following their covenant. No, they can't. Their obsolete covenant can't do that. So this all is traceable back, I think, to Ratzinger. I mean, in a very serious way. What should he have done? And this would be a kind of, what should I say, a dramatic, a kind of thought experiment here. But it goes back to a question. He talks about the guilt that the Germans felt because of Auschwitz. Do you feel guilt because of the firebombing of Dresden?
Yeah.
Do you feel guilt because of the obvious war crime of dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Why should the Germans? Are you telling me that somehow why is this different? Why is it suddenly that only these people should feel guilt? This is my continuation of this thought experiment. I think that the first thing that Ratzinger should have done as the first German pope, in recent memory at least, deal with that issue. Deal with it. German guilt. Deal with it. In some type of sophisticated theological understanding. Because we are all suffering right now. You and me, we are all suffering because of this Jewish tyranny, which is not a category. It's not a category in anyone's discussion.
Well, okay? I mean, bowing to the Holocaust narrative, and that dominates the Second World War, it has neutered the church, because the church now, I guess one of the motivations for Nostra Aetate would have been, I think the background of that is war guilt, the Holocaust, and that's basically the foundation, much of the foundation of Jewish cultural or political power or moral authority, whatever, you know, it claims to have today, being able to preach, you know, point the finger at people and preach people and play the victim is that narrative. And if you don't approach that or engage in that, then you're not going to be able to, one of the reasons why the church isn't seeking to convert Jews and I guess live up to her mission is that issue. And of course, a German Pope who internalizes all that guilt isn't going to be able to do that. However, his uncle, his great uncle rather, took a very different approach to it. And he talked about, and you write in the article, how he talked about what the Jews are doing to the economy in Europe, particularly Germany. But he talked about the superiority of Catholic economics over Jewish economics, approach to the marketplace, sharp Jewish business practices, and sort of the cultural reasons why Jews were able to sort of subvert and take over these things, because of their internalized or their established, the way they engaged in trade was unethical, and they're able to take advantage of a naive, a Christian population. And of course, I guess 7 years before Georg Ratzinger, you had Napoleonic Wars and Jewish emancipation. And in that time, they were able to take over and subvert the economies of Europe. But he was dealing with that issue directly. And it's one thing that's been denied to Catholics and people in general is, priests or people who can dialogue with Jews directly, point the finger at them and preach to them. We don't have a Ratzinger. We don't have a Father Finney anymore who could talk directly about these issues. And because of the institutionalized guilt that not only applies to the German people, but entire Western civilization now.
Right. We're suffering.
Yeah.
So the question is, as Pope, you're the German Pope. You've lived through this whole thing. You know what happened. Okay. And so the question, the faithful, you're talking about guilt. You're talking about Auschwitz. I didn't have anything to do with that. Okay. I was born 3 years after all that happened. I was born in 48 when the whole plan shifted. So I'm afflicted because the whole world is afflicted with this thing. This guilt that we all seem to have inherited, and we don't know why. So the question would be, we'd have to press the Pope. Now we have a German Pope, okay? The question is it a sin to criticize Jews? If you're living in Germany, it's illegal to criticize Jews. That's obvious now. But we need some moral clarification. That's your expertise. You're infallible when it comes to faith and morals. Would you please clarify this issue? It's tearing us apart.
Well, it's gotten so bad now. They just arrested a 96-year-old woman because she was a file clerk at an alleged death camp or concentration camp. And they have no real evidence against her, but they're going to throw her in prison for the rest of her life. They're going to try to do that.
This is horrendous. And now there's a 100-year-old guy there. This is getting close to what the communists did in Spain. You dig up the corpses of nuns and you desecrate the corpse. We're almost to that point here. Okay. Now nobody was tried for war crimes on the American side. Do you mean to tell me there were no war crimes? The whole strategy, American strategy, was based on a war crime, because it was based on the systematic targeting of civilian population by aerial bombardment. That's a war crime.
Here's a Lindemann report that the British and then the Americans adopted when they entered the war. Yeah, it was Anglo-American strategy, terror bombing.
Terrorized the population, began within days. The British inaugurated it, because that was always the strategy with the British Empire, beginning with the invention of the airplane. They terrorized local populations by flying over and destroying villages and spread terror throughout the whole population by doing that. So are we going to have a real serious analysis of guilt accruing from actions in World War II? Well, the German Pope should have done that. That would have been the ideal situation, except that if he had done it, he could have ended up in jail. But that would have been really interesting, too. Are the Germans going to put a German Pope in jail because he's talking about what happened in World War II in a way that is not accessible? Now, I have a friend who's a history teacher in Berlin, and he has to teach a lesson on the Morgenthau Plan. He also has to teach a lesson on the Hungerjahr, and he also has to teach a lesson on the Berlin Airlift, which was the reversal of all those policies. Mm-hmm. So obviously, these are categories of the state-sanctioned official categories of German history. Can we talk about this in some type of dispassionate, moral way? Can the leader of the Catholic Church wade into something this? Now that we have a German, can he deal with what happened in Germany? Well, he didn't. I mean, nothing happened. We had, instead of doing that, we had Catholic-Jewish dialogue, which went nowhere and is still going nowhere. So I said this in the article I just did in the September issue about the Latin Mass. I'm saying summorum pontificorum was passive-aggressive behavior on Ratzinger's part. By which I mean he instead of reforming the liturgy for everyone, he made this Latin Mass indult available for certain people. But it was a covert way of bringing the Jewish question back into play again after all of these years. Now, the Catholic-Jewish Dialogue Commission, the official commission in Germany, said that to him. They, months before, it's in the article, but they wrote him a letter saying, if you go ahead with this, we know your intention. You're trying to bring back the Jewish question. with all those Jewish prayers, you know, about the conversion of the Jews and so on and so forth. I think they're right. I think they were right. I think they knew what was going on, that the whole Latin Mass thing was really a stalking horse for something that he couldn't address. This is what I'm saying with passive aggressive behavior. It's like the classic defeated nation behavior. So I can't address it explicitly. Let's reform the liturgy if you want to do that. Let's talk about morality here. Let's talk about history. No, we can't do that. So we'll do it in a passive aggressive way by bringing back the Latin Mass. And the Latin Mass then becomes weaponized and a stalking horse for things that we can't really talk about.
Your treatment of Kevin MacDonald, you talk about the three Kevin MacDonalds. And it goes to what you claim is sort of a inner contradiction of his approach, about this Darwinian approach. At the same time, he's critical and condemns Jewish behavior, but based on his sociobiological Darwinian approach, it's justifiable outside any moral consideration. That's one thing distinguishes his critique, say, from Georg Ratzinger, who saw, Catholicism as being morally superior to Judaism, and the solution to the Jewish question is conversion. And the propagation of the Catholic faith, and it's also
enforcing the laws on the books.
Yeah, the enforcing
against usury, for example.
Yeah, and one of the things that harmed Russian civilization, Christianity in particular, was the removal of these restrictions, given the behavior and actions of the Jews. Now, the distinction is, Ratzinger would point out, the behavior and actions of Jews, and not their DNA. Whereas later criticism of Judaism, the anti-Semitism developed in the late 19th century would have been more racial. And that, of course, that had a profound effect in the 20th century. And Kevin MacDonald's approach, because he's Darwinian, it's materialist, although his research on Jewish behavior and activism is superb, I guess his approach sociobiological is insufficient because it reduces everything down to DNA. And so the sort of this behavioral people they're doing it because of their DNA,
Which means that they're robots, automatons, which means they have no free will. Well, why are we talking about that? It's like saying, are we talking about morality in salmon? Is there something we need to do to change them? No, they don't have morality. They act according to stimuli. Well, he's saying the same thing is true of human beings, which makes all of this critique unnecessary or pointless. And on top of that, so the difference is that Georg Ratzinger would say, they got to where they are because they cheated. Kevin, I think, thinks that they have superior intelligence. They won out in the battle, the survival of the fittest. They came out on top. Well, that's the end of the story if you're a sociobiologist. What else are you going to do? And then you get this note of admiration that these white boys, they really would like to be Jews. You know, if we could only have a Zionist white boy culture, and that gets us right back to the whole, Jewish Nazi thing. Two sides of the same coin. So basically, you got Kevin's critique. There's the Catholic boy who, had some training in morals, throwing it overboard with the sexual revolution. But, the repressed comes back and he's annoyed at the Jews. There's this moral indignation at what the Jews are doing to our culture. But then he can't back that up with his sociobiology, because we should just have unbridled admiration for the Jews because they're superior to us, and their proof they're superior is because they took over our culture. So that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
What do
so
we do?
What's there to criticize if it's sort of a natural process?
Right. What's there to criticize? So he's a deeply conflicted guy. I wish he would just go to confession and come back to the Catholic faith, but that's the mysteries of God's grace interacting with the soul. We can always hope that will happen.
Well, then it comes back to a choice. So this, when I sent you the email, it's either Hitler or Christ, right?
Yes. That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. I know it's blunt. It's maybe overly simplistic, but you're right. People, one thing I do detect, and you've said it, that, it's Protestants who don't go to church anymore. And
that's what a white boy is.
Yeah. And of course they they create this white identity because of all the agitation against white people and these sort of things. So it's kind of the thing where every other ethnic group has their identity and they're constantly talking about it. But if you're white, you can't talk about it. So you're kind of put in this category, then you're trapped. It's a difficult situation politically. And also given the fact that, you know, I guess the powers that be appear to be creating these categories for one reason or another.
Yes.
Well,
they create them. They create categories to demonize you. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who don't understand this and they adopt the category that their oppressors want them to adopt. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much a white boy at this point, you know. And then if you try to explain to them, which I did in that debate with Jared Taylor, wait a minute, this is not really your identity. They get uppity and they get upset and they accuse me of being a race denier or some weird crime like that. No, that's not it. That's not it. This is a demonization process. And if you want to adopt the demons, the labels of your oppressors, well, go ahead, but don't expect to win anytime soon if you do that. I've said this before, but that's exactly what happened. The opposite happened in St. Louis when I said, no, the people that are trying to preserve the statue, they're not white supremacists, they're Catholics. As soon as I made that claim stick, they won. And the statue is still standing in St. Mm-hmm. Louis. Yeah, it was identity theft. Umar Lee was engaging in identity theft. And that's a classic. That's exactly what happened to the German people. It was identity theft. They've had their identity stolen. The Jews stole their identity. They gave them a false identity. And like the white boy who turns around at the biker rally when someone yells, "Hey, asshole," they have internalized the commands of their oppressors. And this is a catastrophe for everyone. It's not just for the Germans, but it's for everyone. That's the problem. If you don't work for the conversion of the Jews, you end up condemning, if you say they don't need to be baptized, if you don't bring that up, you condemn the Jews to hell in the next life because baptism is necessary for salvation. But the other side is you condemn the rest of us to hell in this life because you're ensuring Jewish hegemony over the culture. And we're all suffering from that now, both here and in Europe.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you point out in the article, you know, we talked about earlier in the interview, you talked about Jewish terrorism and acts of violence, and you open the article talking about that. And I think it was Jared Loughner who shot Gabby Giffords murdered a few other people, a little girl, if I recall. He was at first identified as a right-winger extremist, and then it turns out that he was Jewish.
Wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Let's go back to right-winger then.
And didn't he go to the same synagogue?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, as Gabby Giffords.
Yeah, yeah. So Dorothy Rabinowitz talks about this Muslim who shot people on a military base, mm-hmm. And talks about identity politics. Well, they created identity politics. You know, it's just never gets reported. Baruch Goldstein murdered a mass murderer, but we don't talk about it because he's a Jew, and Jews are always victims.
Yeah, he killed 29 people. And that's not on people's conscience.
It was a hate crime, and it was based on, he was a follower of Meir Kahan, the Jewish Defense League. But we don't talk about that. Polite people don't talk about this kind of stuff.
No, and the it's funny you mentioned an article where Abe Foxman immediately, upon being confronted with or dealing with the fact that Jerry Loughner was Jewish, it says, well, he was a conspiracy theorist, anti-government guy.
So we need a label. We have to get a label out there as soon as possible, because the one thing we can't talk about is his actual identity.
Yeah. So if he had been Christian, the first thing would have been that this guy's a Christian, you know, or that he's white. Yeah, but then he's Jewish. It became these other things. Apply another label to it. And again, in the article, you discuss things like where Dorothy Rabinowitz was complaining about, I guess this was that Major Hassan who shot up the army base. And of course, it was in the article, you discuss Jewish role in immigration and changing the immigration laws in this country that would create the diversity that they celebrate. And you write, the reason why they do this, and you cite people like Professor McDonald and other people, even Jews, how Jews promote diversity because they flourish in it because they don't want to have an homogenous or cohesive ethnic, I guess, majority to deal with. So they like a pluralistic society where there's no, I guess, coordination or a sense of community. And they create a babble that they can then operate in. And they openly talk about that. And that explains the decades-long Jewish activism in reforming United States immigration laws. Yeah,
it's still working. The ADL came out and demanded that Tucker Carlson be fired because he talked about replacement theory. Mm-hmm. Well, the whole Jewish immigration strategy has been nothing but replacement theory, beginning with the change in the immigration laws in 1965, which was a totally Jewish creation. It was Jacob Javits and Emanuel Sellers who didn't want any more Europeans contributing to a kind of European culture, America having European culture. So you just bring a lot of people from a lot of different places. And it's like, what's it like now? It's like going to Walmart in Virginia, where who's working at Walmart? They can't even talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try and talk to them. There's always this language barrier. Or it's like the policy, the diversity policy at Amazon. The memo got linked. Why are they interested in diversity at Amazon? Why is it that you have a lunchroom where there are 112 different languages being spoken here? Because they can't unionize.
Yes.
It's that simple.
Yeah, yes. And to this now, we have just today, Mayorkas, our head of the Department of Homeland Security, said that he wasn't going to screen newcomers in the country, or wasn't going to intervene, have his people intervene to prevent illegal immigration, something to that effect. And then
you have someone like Barbara Lerner Spector in that famous video where she's saying, yeah, we Jews are flooding Europe with immigrants to destroy their culture, but they need our help because this is really Tikkun Olam, and Jews have a crucial role to play in turning Europe into a multicultural society. Well, wait a minute. Who gave you permission to wreck these people's culture? You appointed yourself because you believe in Tikkun Olam, and Tikkun Olam means you have a right to destroy anybody's culture or anybody's life because you have this moral superiority and Jewish privilege. By the way, someone just was attacking somebody for anti-Semitism, and they mentioned in the whole list of blah, 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 one of the things they mentioned was the canard of Jewish privilege. Wait a minute, that's not a canard, and I'm responsible for it. I launched that term. I had a book, an Amazon ebook on that. They became a bestseller.
Yeah, Jewish privilege. Well, that is, let me see this article. What we have here, and there was an article, let me see if I can find it. Yeah, this is by Alex McNabb. A dissident magazine. He calls this performative contradiction. And it says, the ADL and other Jewish advocacy groups love the cluster of pearls over the so-called canard of Jewish influence on American politics. They decry millennia-old stereotypes of Jews as disloyal, greedy abusers of power. But then with zero trace of irony, take swift public action that totally confirms the anti-Semites' initial premise, the propositional logic. This is in propositional logic. This is known as a performative contradiction. You cannot claim that it's an anti-Semitic myth to state Jews have outsized political power, then immediately summon powerful political connections to ostracize and or silence anyone making the claim.
Right.
So and you see that with he cites Vice President Harris, who actually. I guess politely received the question about someone voicing concern. I think this is at George Mason University about the Palestinians. And admittedly, all the Jewish power came down on Vice President Harris. The ADL Greenblatt got involved in it just because she entertained the validity of the question.
She didn't jump up and denounce the person immediately and call for the police to arrest her for making that comment.
But it's amazing how closely they observe and watch American politics. You know, they were upset because I think there was a vote to give billions of dollars so Israel could replenish its Iron Dome system. And the vote was like 409 to 27 or 420 to 9. and they were concerned about the nine votes.
Right, right. Full spectrum dominance of the American political system. That's what we're talking about here.
So okay, I think we're up close to an hour now.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Sure.
Did we cover it?
I think so.
Of the article or the chapter rather. Okay. Yeah, that chapter is in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and its impact on world history. That's volume 3. I've been going through the third chapter, because I read the original book. And so I want to get some of the newer material. And actually what I find is you can open up any chapter. You don't have to read it in sequence. It's all, you know, you can just pick up these various, some chapters are shorter than others. So I hardly recommend it, of course. And of course, I guess I'll let you go. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Culture Wars Magazine.
Culture Wars Magazine, go to culturewars.com for the magazine or go to fidelitypress.org for all of the books that we've mentioned on the show tonight.
Great. Thank you so much. You have a good evening then.
You too, Tim.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.